Hello, welcome to this episode of My Fermented Life. Thanks for joining us as we document the journey of an entrepreneur and his family as they pursue their dreams of building a food and beverage brand. Follow along as we discuss events, lessons, and meet some really cool people along the way. Now, this week's episode is brought to you by Madge's Food, making fermented food and beverages tastier and healthier, 1 billion microbes at a time. And now, the king of kimchi, the baron of Bloody Mary, and the Maharaji of micheladas, your host, Michael Miller. Mike Miller, welcome to another episode of My Fermented Life. Today, this is the new episode, September 14, 2018, is hopefully when you're listening to this. Thank you for tuning in again. Hey, if you're the first-time listener, welcome. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, even Google, or your favorite podcaster app. Just so glad to have you back. Also, we're going to start recording this, and it should be on My Fermented live video on Facebook. So, hey, please reach out to us on Facebook at My Fermented Life or even on Twitter. Send us a tweet. Please leave comments, questions, or just funny smart-ass jokes would be great too. So I'm really excited about today. Today is somebody I've got to know over probably the last year, year and a half. Definitely somebody who's rocking and rolling around the food industry, both locally, but not only locally, nationally. This is a guy that's running out to cooking competitions around the states and really kicking some ass. It's really exciting. Not only that, I think this is going to be a little cool episode too, because it's more than just about the food and business. I think there's some really good kind of social aspects that are going around here with both more of human interest and maybe even a little into politics. And I'm really staying away from politics like the third rail. And maybe this is not type of politics I agree with. But that's not the point, right? I think the point is I find people that are intriguing, that are interesting, and our next guest is definitely one of those people.
Thank you.
So I want to welcome you to James Cantor of Gorilla Gourmet.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mike. I'm looking forward to being here today. You know, sit down and chat with you, having a few drinks, and seeing what the fermented life is all about, besides getting fermented all the time.
Absolutely. Now, we're going to give a quick shout-out to our friends at 903 Brewers. They gave us this Mexican lager called Cerveza Por Favor. This is a cool little company up in, like, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. It's a small little brewer. So if you're not from, like, San Antonio, South Texas, you probably don't know about them. But if you're up from the DFW area, there's a cute little brewer. Really good beer. So just give them a shout-out. Thanks. So
good stuff. It pairs well, it says here, with street tacos, queso fresco, and pool floaties.
Pool floaties?
Pool floaties.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't agree with them more.
We give them a shout-out. But, yeah, if people don't know you, hopefully this podcast is going out more than just San Antonio, that people are out there. Who is James Cantor?
Ooh, that's tough. Well, James Cantor. Well, I'm just a straightforward blue-collar kind of guy. I'm out here scratching and clawing, for a couple of dimes like everybody else, taking care of my family, three young boys, Finn, he's the oldest, 12. Jack and Harlan are twins, they're 9, and then my wife, Maureen. Been in the cooking game a long time, born and raised into it, actually, and hopped around the continent and beyond doing that. Just want to be out here doing what I love, enjoying my life, and that means cooking and helping people and taking care of my family, man.
Now, are you from Texas, or are you from...
I'm not from Texas, but I hurried up and got here as quick as I could.
Smart.
As the saying goes.
So where's hometown?
Well, originally from a small town. It's on a tributary of the Chesapeake Bay, Elkton, Maryland. Transplanted to Clearwater Beach, Florida when I was 13. Grew up there until I was about 19 and went to California for the first time, L.A. Skateboarding, mainly, and got a little taste of the West Coast and... Spent about 10 or 15 years off and on over the West Coast from, Orange County, Tijuana, all the way up to Alaska. A majority of the years were in San Francisco. But, anywhere in between, too. Montana, Detroit, New York, you name it, brother.
So here's a chef that can probably cook the meanest burger at the same time, probably do an axle grind. That's I love that, man. That's
maybe if I wouldn't have ate so many burgers, I might be able to still do that axle grind. But yeah, I'd probably get up on one.
What, you know, how long have you been in the food business, and what got you into it?
Well, like I said, I was pretty much born into it and raised in it. My uncle owned a seafood market and seafood restaurant in a small town that was on the a tributary of the Chesapeake Bay. It was called the Big Elk River. They served, you know, all the local seafood fresh out of the bay there. I was exposed to that at a very young age. You know, growing up, my mother worked as a prep cook in the kitchen. Brothers were chefs there. Uncles owned it. Aunts, cousins were all working in there. And I remember during the summers and after school, you know, my mother was single mother, raised three boys on her own. So after school, she would I'd either get a ride to the restaurant or she would come pick me up, and I would be at the restaurant until she was finished for the day. So, you know, I'm just kind of kicking around and, you know, looking at all the cool things, cooking and things of that nature. And during the summers, I would spend most of my time there at the restaurant. My mom would make me a nice little nest under the prep table for nap time. But my babysitter was a CIA graduate chef. Her name was Cheryl. She was the chef at the restaurant. And that's who I kind of hung out with there. And that fed my love for what I do now. That's what's, you know, when things get tough and things are topsy-turvy, I always reach back to that, and that's what grounds me.
You know, it's kind of intriguing. I've always wondered, you know, you go to these family restaurants, and you see, you know, in the afternoon, the kids are there. It's like their life revolves around it, right? They don't have much of a life like normal kids. They literally sit there. I always wonder, it's kind of unique that instead of you, like, embracing it and saying, screw you, I never want to be involved, you made it part of who you are, and you just, obviously, still you've been doing it. So.
Yeah. Well, I love food, obviously. You know, I was raised in the business. You know, I tried other things. My dad's half of the world, half the business, or half of his side of the world is construction. He's a hell of a cook, though. Mountain guy, North Carolina, Appalachian, Asheville, Boone area. It's where some of my other family live also. You know, I went and worked with him for a while. Wasn't really my cup of tea. I've done all kinds of crazy odds and end jobs, and they always lead me back to cooking or into a kitchen, and that's where I feel alive the most. I feel, even when it's, you know, the wheels are falling off and it's catching fire, that's where I feel the most comfortable. It's a strange and magical and weird place to be, to find solace and comfort in such a tumultuous and dangerous place it can be. You know, you don't think of it like that, but like, you know, a high volume kitchen or a commercial kitchen's pretty scary stuff for the novice, man.
Well, you know, the good thing too about running a food truck, if it never works out with the food side, you can become an excellent small engine repair person.
Oh my God!
With all your generators, man. Right?
Oh my Lord! Plumber, you know, welder. I mean, yeah, you name it. It's. I didn't really start working until I became a food truck operator. That's when I really started working in the business, and I already had put in 25, almost 30 years into the business before that. So it's a tough game.
So now let's talk about your food truck. Your food truck's called Gorilla Gourmet, correct?
It is Gorilla Gourmet.
So tell us about Gorilla Gourmet.
Well, so
I mean, I'm assuming you don't feed gorillas at zoos. That's not what you're trying to do.
For the right price, absolutely. I'll feed gorillas, emus, ibex, whatever, man. It doesn't matter. That's we're in this game to feed.
It's called the hustle.
Yes, it's the hustle. But Gorilla Gourmet was basically the last job I took was at a country club in Victoria, Texas, and I told my GM there. He was, you know, wanted to know what my future was, what I saw for my future, and I go, well, I can tell you, man, I am about three jobs past from owning my own deal. And he said, well, give me 3 years. I go, I'll try to give you two. We'll see what we can do. I lasted just under 2 years. I had been talking to now this is a six-figure-a-year job, mind you, and I still couldn't hold my attention. It got boring. Mm. And that's another thing about the restaurant business. When you get bored in one facet, you can go try another facet. And that's kind of what's been my schooling throughout the years. Food truck game. Basically, when I left the country club, I was offered, an investor offered me some money to open up a food truck. And I had toyed with the idea, but never really, went for it. So we went back and forth. I left the country club as the chef there, and I toyed back and forth with the investor about either a restaurant or a food truck, and we fooled around for about a few months before we actually made a move. We decided to go with the truck, and the reason was the region I was in was a very untested region for me. I had been in a kind of a private sector, so it was kind of a captive audience. So I didn't know how my food was going to be received in the public sector. So I finally said, and this is small town Texas, mind you, it's completely, not really what I'm used to, even though I've spent a lot of my last 10 years in small town Texas until moving to San Antonio. But I said, I figure if I get a truck, I can at least pull up stakes and drive my kitchen to the next gig, so to speak. So we went with the truck, and thinking about names, I was thinking about names for the restaurant, and Gorilla Gourmet kept popping up, but it didn't fit. When we purchased the truck, we said Gorilla Gourmet. That's what it's going to be, and that name or that moniker actually came from a TV show that I helped develop in LA 10 years prior. Picked up by a couple of companies who helped fund it and develop it, and never got sold. But it was it went through three name changes. The final one was Gorilla Gourmet, and it spelled like Gorilla Warfare. Mm-hmm. It seemed perfect for a food truck. Gorilla style gourmet food, and the emblem on the side, the branding is a big gorilla. So it's kind of like our food. It's a twist on it's a play on words or twisting of words and ideas. You have a gorilla warfare, but you have a gorilla as the emblem. It's the same with our food. We might give you some great chicken wings, but we're going to put some mesquite smoke on it. We're going to hit it with some cowboy, Korean-influenced cowboy barbecue sauce. Hit it with a couple of, very unique, probably Southeast Asian-inspired
kombu briny I've seen you do.
Yes. So, we that's kind of where the name came from, and that's kind of where the food is at, too. But the actual branding itself, when I lived that first year I lived in California in LA, my roommate, who we went to visit, was sponsored by XL, the XL store, Extra Large,
okay.
Who is was owned by one of the Beastie Boys. And the XL store was right next to our apartment, and we were pretty much given carte blanche to go into the store and pick whatever we wanted at any time. And the emblem was the gorilla, a bust of the gorilla. And I always liked that branding. So when I said, okay, Gorilla Gourmet, I kind of took that idea and kind of turned it into my own, and that's where it was. But, this Gorilla Gourmet thing is so much morphed into just a food truck or a brand. It's become a philanthropical element to it, and there's a political element to it, and there's an educational element to it. It's a lot bigger than I ever thought it would or could be. I just wanted to make money cooking.
Yeah.
But it's
well, that's true. Let's talk about that. I think one of the things that intrigues me, getting to know Canada over the last year, if you're not from around here or South Texas, about a year ago, we had a major hurricane that came on land, and you actually lived right in the epicenter where that hurricane came up through. So you were living in Victoria, Texas at the time, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, it stalled right on us for a couple of days.
So this is where the story becomes, to me, intriguing, more of a human interest story, and where I think anybody out there can really bring, whether it's a company or a brand or, in this case, a food truck, to do more than just make food. Can you tell people the story of what happened last year or Hurricane Harvey?
Sure. Yeah, it was almost a year ago to this week, man. It was something that, it changed my perspective on life and what I do forever. I'll go to the grave with a whole different viewpoint as to what I do and what I can do. It was tragic and amazing and wonderful and magical and scary, all wrapped up into one deal. Hurricane season, Gulf Coast, pretty typical fashion. We got storms coming off the west coast of Africa, except this one, they named Harvey. started in on us. And as it got closer and closer, it started intensifying, getting closer. The trajectory was getting closer to where we were at. And finally, the day or two before, they categorized class 5, I believe it was, category 5. And there was mandatory evacuation in Victoria. We, for some reason, weren't going to pay attention to that. We thought we'd be fine. And at the last minute, it got really bad. So
I think if I remember right, your reasoning was, hey, this had been through a hurricane in the 30s or something like that?
Yeah, so we lived in a pier and beam house, old 1940s farmhouse, and we were going to stay there until we couldn't.
Yeah.
And the day before the hurricane actually hit, that was when there was a mandatory evacuation. By that time, we were kind of entrenched. It was our first home. We had everything we owned there. We built our life there. We were going to try to, you know, hold it out, but then the weather got so bad. Last minute, we just went and boarded everything up and battened down the hatches, and we barricaded ourselves into the restaurant downtown, into the Gorilla Gourmet Luncheonette. It was second oldest family-owned newspaper in the state of Texas, Victoria Advocate. It's where Popeye was invented. Little fun fact.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It was on the same grid, a power grid, as the police station and the jail and the bank. And this building had been through a few Category 4s and maybe a 5, from what I understand also. It was a big, giant cinder block, and it was, you know, very well built. So I figured, okay, last minute, we get these boards up, we go down there. I got all the more food in the world down there. We have backup generators. The newspaper is actually reporting and has been reporting for a week now, pretty much around the clock out of there. I figure if shit went sideways, we at least had good communications with the newspaper. They knew, you know, they would know how to get out if all else failed. Plus, they had backup generators, and there was plenty of resources, is what I'm saying. So we barricade ourselves in there, and we started cooking, pretty much cooking, because the storm was intensifying. I got nervous. My family's in there. You know, we had a tent in the dining room. All the dogs are in there, the cats. So, you know, I put them to bed, and I stayed up on watch. You know, I cooked them dinner, and I just kept cooking. Pots started getting bigger. The kimchi stew, I remember how that smoked kimchi I made. That went into a stew. It went and made kimchi stew, and the pot started out about, you know, I don't know, five quarts. It ended up like 50 quarts. The thing was huge. Stayed on the stove for like 4 days. Turned into a different soup every 24 hours. You know, the next thing I knew was that, people started coming to the cafe. First, the reporters. They'd been up there eating, you know, cheese and crackers for days already, like reporting on the storm. So they smelled hamburgers and dinner I was cooking, and they were like, dude, we didn't know you're here. You want to cook something for us? We'll pay you. I was like,
this is all while the hurricane's going on.
This is as it's starting to intensify. It hasn't hit us yet, but it's getting ready to. We just, we did some Facebook posts prior, you know, that day, and everything had closed down in the 7-county area, all the restaurants at least. So I started getting people seeing my Facebook posts from Goliad and Cuero, and they came over and they wanted just to have a meal. And everything else was closed up, so they said, you know, let's go to Gorilla Gourmet. They seemed like the only ones open. So I had people come in, and they're, you know, knocking on the doors like, hey, you guys open? I go, sure. The stove's on. I got some food. Sure, come on in. You know, they ordered some food. I had one gentleman. He was like, we just want, you know, five hamburgers and fries for the family, some drink. I was like, okay. So he's like, how much? I go, you know, whatever you want to pay, dude. He's like, here's $150. I go, and that was when the pay what you can idea came to fruit. I said, well, $150, man. This guy gave me $150 for 5 burgers and fries and 5 drinks. I floated him a couple of beers that I had stashed.
This is not Kobe beef.
It's local grass fed beef. You know, I can't remember the brand at the time, but one of the local farms in Victoria. They had a great meal, and I made them the hamburgers. They left, And then I had some other people show up. And then the newsroom guys came down, like, wanted hamburgers. So I made, like, at that point I had made, like, 20 hamburgers for them. And, you know, I had been working off this money this guy gave me and been donating it to these people for free. The word got out. There was no more power. The power started going out. We were the only ones with power in seven counties for a couple of days. We were kind of a beacon. People started coming to us and saw the lights on, heard that we were feeding people, and next thing you know, I'm cooking for 100 people here, 200 people here, 300 people there. You know, a couple days later, I'm up to about 1,000 people, and it's me and a few volunteers that were, friends of family and people, customers of mine that were helping me out. And then the Chefs Cooperative came in, thank God, and they brought in all their resources, and we started feeding up to 3,000 people a day. I think what our largest day was 4,000 people.
That's insane.
And yeah, I say about 9 days, within 9 to 10 days, we fed approximately 20,000 people from in our location and outerlying hot shots we were putting out too. It was intense, man.
I mean, that's a year later, and I still get goosebumps.
Oh shit, man! Yeah, I'm like, yeah, dude,
knowing the story and following
crazy,
it,
man.
It's just insane.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, also I forgot to mention, like, as soon as the hurricane had hit us and stalled on us, and then rocked back out towards Houston. I got my family in the car, and I told them to get to Houston, my wife and kids. They got turned around, like, twice. Their routes were cut off from floods. But they finally turned back and then went back out and got to Austin and stayed there. I said, you know, they asked me if I was going to come with them. I was like, no, I got things to do here. I feel like I'm supposed to be here.
Yeah.
I just felt like I was supposed to be there, and I'm supposed to be cooking. That's what I felt. And once they got to safety, that's when the real work began. And, boy, did it, man! I mean, you were there, weren't you? Did you come down?
No, I helped what I could.
Okay, gotcha.
I was a guy on the phone making light plants happen, and
gotcha.
Everything I could do, I was kind of
stuck here.
And
yeah,
and I support those guys at
the
Chef Cooperative. Shout out to those guys. I mean, they really stepped up. And,
well, y'all did, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it was no one played a small or a large role.
Yeah.
I feel like it all was very important, no matter what it was, man. I mean, if it wasn't for the lights, we would have had some issues. We'd had some major issues. I mean, because we were cooking 24/7, around the clock. We could only handle so much in the kitchen. We ended up having two or three more mobile kitchens, excuse me, outside in the parking lot, which the light fueled that. I mean, if we didn't have that light,
yeah,
it could have been a lot more difficult.
I bet you saw the best of humans and the worst of humans. But I think at the end of the day, also, when tragedy happens, how people can come together from different backgrounds, different ideologies, and at the end of the day, it's about feeding people and making people feel safe. And even if it's a moment of security, that's kind of what the role that you played.
That, absolutely, dude. I tell you what, when you scrape away all the static and all the stuff that distracts you on a regular daily basis in society and this world, you throw all that stuff in the trash, and you're face to face with each other, and you're both in need of something, and there's nowhere else to turn. You see things that you cannot ever deny again.
You see that human again.
You look into the eyes of humanity.
Yeah.
If there's any way to describe looking into the eyes of holiness, that is it, man. Because that is truly. I'll never forget that moment when everything was silenced, and we had all varieties of people, races, colors, financial classes. There couldn't have been more different variety of people in this room at any given time, all needing the same thing.
And just to make sure, you weren't here to make money. I mean, a lot of this you were just providing, and you were accepting donations, and you were putting a call out to anybody.
Yes.
I think there's also a lot of companies that stepped up and
ton of companies
brought you, you know, a lot of food and meat and protein.
Absolutely. And, well, you know, so the first – what was interesting about when the Chefs Cooperative came in, I had already spent almost my entire business capital serving people. It was about $15,000. That's all I had there, you know, small mom and pop business. So so I was getting ready to hit rock bottom. My wife calls me and says, hey, you're about to go belly up, man. You're about to – you're not going to have enough money to do anything anymore. She goes, we need to come up with a solution to this. So she suggested a GoFundMe account, and that was – I was like, I don't know, man. I hate asking people for money and all that. So she did it, and I said, okay, go ahead and do it. You do it. You just take care of everything, and we'll work from there. And we'll put a call out to Chef's Cooperative and see what they can do. And then our Facebook posts. Well, what's interesting, that's when all the donations started flooding in. And that's when all the response came. And it seems like when we ran out of one thing and put a word out, it would be there right when we ran out of the next thing. So, yeah, it was all donated. And I tell you, man, it's so difficult for me to remember details of that whole deal. And one of my greatest fears is that I have not given the people or the company or a person or a company or a group of people or entities the credit that they deserve for what they did. So I can only hope and wish that if someone had a part to play in it, they would step up and take the credit and tell us, hey, you know, on some of the posts that I make, like, hey, I'm glad I could have done this for you. I'm glad I could have done that for you. Because I was in such, you know, survival mode at that point, and I had been not sleeping for days, and just the adrenaline and the fear and all the above, man. Just really, that's the only thing I really freaking remember. So my greatest fear is that I will leave those people out that did things, you know, even if it was just like make a call to the light guy, you know what I mean? Like, that's huge. There were so many people involved. You know, I just say thank you to all of them. You know, thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. The city of Victoria definitely thanks you. If you ever come across me or come across a post that I make about, you know, the storm, please let it be known who you are and what you did. I still want to know. Yeah. I still revisit it all the time because it's there's so many things that I still reflect on from that. It's crazy, man.
Well, all of us here and all our listeners here, you know, they can pass that word on too, that how grateful everybody, you know, that you are to these people. So
I tell you, I'm sorry we had to break this into two episodes. Hopefully by now you're very teased by this. Definitely going to need to check in next week because we include this amazing interview. I won't give you the details, but I still think looking back, this is going to be probably one of the best interviews I've done up to this date. You know, I probably say that every week. But every week it seems getting better. Unfortunately, you have to wait a whole another week to hear what happened. But please check in back next Friday as we release episode 2, where you can conclude this amazing interview with an amazing person, James Canner, the Gorilla Gourmet. Anyway, let's move on. This is the time of the show now where we talk about Madge's Moment, kind of an update on what's going on with us and Madge's food. I'm having so much fun with these podcasts, but this week has been a very tough week, a very busy week, and a very exciting week in the ups and downs of the food business. I'm just so happy you guys continue listening to this. We hope we're bringing value. You know, we'd love to hear back from you, whether it's you know, an email or something on Twitter or Facebook or, you know, some comments. We'd definitely love some input. Also, you know what, if you know anybody that you think would be an amazing guest that you'd like to see on the show, you know, reach out to us. We're always looking for new guests. And as we start to do this weekly, you know, we know we've got to have, you know, 52 plus interviewees, you know, a year. So we're always looking for intriguing people. Please get in touch with us. But I'll tell you, before we get into Madge's Moment, I just want to quickly check in on the podcast. You know, I'll tell you, as someone who's working the food now has to learn a lot about podcasting. There's so much to learn. You know, sound engineering, producing, mixing, all this stuff is just amazing. Way over my head. I'm learning. It's getting better. I hope so. I definitely learned the challenges a couple episodes ago when we did outdoor interviews. Definitely some challenges with mics and distances between them. Production value is not as high as you're used to, but hey, you know, this is part of our journey, right? We start off bootstrapping. You know, I work little side hustles late at night so I can earn more money for equipment so we can better this podcast, because all the money that Madge's makes gets reinvested in that company for growth and being very disciplined and making sure that this podcast grows organically from a budget standpoint as well. So, but tonight we're doing it kind of enjoying on the back porch here at Magis Central at our home, actually smoking a cigar out here, finishing off this lovely episode of the podcast. You know, sometimes we just have to take those moments to relax and kick back and enjoy. And I guess I'm having so much fun getting to know these different guests of ours and then hopefully, you know, giving you our story. So just sit back and enjoy, and let's get into that Magis moment. We had an interesting week. We had September 11th here, 2018, this week, and remember what happened so long ago. Didn't have much time to sit there and think about, though. This week was a very taxing, busy week. I'm still kind of looking back going, and the week's not even done yet. We still have a very packed weekend, but we are definitely moving into the busy season. I think everybody out there, or if you really want to know when things get crazy, it's definitely fourth quarter is coming up, right? We got this last month, we're fourth quarter, especially in the liquor business. That's a very busy, busy, busy business. Very busy, busy season. We look forward to it. Hopefully we'll have a little better anticipating the demands and our production this year than last year. Man, coming off of summer, a little slow there always and towards the end of August, but it just all of a sudden dropped on us this week. A lot of, you know, you've kind of been hearing the turmoil or the story, you know, one of our big markets. Everything's been kind of smoothed over now, and I think we're all clear, and we did get the PO and the reorder, so now we're back. As usual, you know, we always like to have 3-week notice, and we usually get about a week. And so, you know, we have to kind of make things happen without sacrificing quality of product. And that's something I'm very strict about. I'll continue to tell them not yet, not yet, not yet, if it doesn't meet my standard of taste. I'm very picky about our quality of product. We do make mistakes. We have had some inconsistency in batches, but that's very far and few between. I look for the day where, you know, we can invest in all kinds of neat little gadgets for quality control and have somebody that's all they do is go around testing everything. Always have like the most consistent. But in the meantime, we rely on what God gave us, which was a very good tongue and sense of palate. Until that's plenty of test equipment for me. So anyway, yeah, we had to meet a big order really quick on the kimchi, and that's always exasperated by Amazon. Love Amazon, especially after weekends. We get hit with big orders for kimchi, but it also interferes with, at the same time for us at our production level, to meet our store orders. That's always, they always say that's a good thing to have. And I'm like, you know what? Yeah, but it gets irritating over a while. It's really hard at our level to anticipate the demand. And yet, you know, I've told you before, I don't like to say no or wait. So we always try to do our best. Now, hopefully we'll start to understand. I think we've been doing Amazon long enough. We can kind of anticipate what we're getting from a week to week sales. And now I think we can look back to our first 3 months with our wholesale, our retailer, and kind of anticipate, you know, what kind of demand is. So that's been great. But then we got some good stuff going on too. It looks like we're getting into another chain of grocery stores in a city area, not the whole chain, but at least in one little market we're gonna launch this with. So it's a relationship, right? We want to build relationships not only with our distributor. This is a different distributor for us, so we're excited. This is a distributor I've actually known for since I first got into the food business. So I'm very excited to actually work with them at another level. I'm kind of curious about this. I think the challenge we faced here was, you know, this is a product that we've been playing with. It's definitely one of our top selling products. But we decided to kind of innovate even more with a different size. Sometimes, I think I've said this before, right? Innovation can happen not only in the product itself, as far as new formulation, new spin on things, but also you can disrupt or innovate your industry based on the packaging, right? Not really innovating it, because we're not the first person that's doing a smaller version of it. But I think it really fits where we feel there's more consumers. Plus, with us being a higher price point, this is a great opportunity to get new consumers to buy our product. They're definitely interested in that size. We had to bottle and fill a bunch of these cases. And then all of a sudden it hit me. I'm like, wait a minute. This is going to a grocery store. We've only been selling this at farmers markets. We don't have a label that's going to meet most grocery stores' requirements. And it hit me. It's like, oh, crap. Now what am I going to do? Here it is. 48 hours. I need labels. Most label houses need 10 days. And I'm like, oh, crap, now what? Well, luckily the warehouse or the food hub that we're a part of, you know, there's a lot of other businesses in there, even though 90% of us are all food. But luckily, one of my friends, a guy that you've heard here on this podcast, he was smart enough and wise enough to bring a few other people in-house into his office. One of them is a graphic designer that has a nice little printing machine. So we were able to quickly come up with a label that will be more presentable into a grocery retail platform. Printed them all off. And it's not like I haven't done labels before, but I learned a lesson again that before, and this is hopefully something I can save you the time and effort, before you ever do a full run on printing labels, print off a paper copy on your desk jet, cut it out, and then tape it onto your package to do a test. Because I learned the hard way again, and I should have known this. I've done this before, and that's usually my MO, is every time we do a new package, a new label, we print it out, we cut it, we tape it, we see how it looks, we see how to adjust it. Well, because we had this time crunch, right? I mean, it's like I've been promising people for a week we're going to get this stuff to them, but I'll tell you, it's just, to digress, yeah, we got this order probably over a week ago, and I was like, okay, we're on it. You know, next thing you know, we're like, man, we're out of bottles. I'm like, oh, crap, so we got to order bottles. And then, you know, we're out of jars. Like, oh, crap, we got to order jars. And then it's like, trucks don't pick up on time, and we got delayed, we got weather going on. We've had, the other day, we had a truck explode on the highway, shutting down the entire city. And it's like, you know, here we are all, I wasn't the only one in our space. I was out of containers. We had all these orders to fill, but we had no containers, and we're all waiting for them. And we had to wait until like 6 o'clock at night to finally get our containers. And then we worked late into the night to finish these orders. It's the unexpected, right? The unexpected will happen in this business. Prepare for it. Do your best to cajole people into getting things to deliver on time. Just got to stay on it. I really like to meet my order deadlines and requirements because I know people like to get products out before the weekend, you know, to especially grocery stores. So it's very important to me that we get a quick turnaround. But stuff's going to happen, you know, especially at our size and our stage. It's really difficult to buy in quantity to store so we never run out. That's something we're definitely working on the staff to say, hey, if you identify we're running something low, let us know early enough so we can order. Things take time from a cash flow standpoint, from a turnaround and ordering. The time to tell me that we're running out of something is not when you're putting the last seal on the jar on, right? It's like about 500 seals before you get there. But so that's, you know, definitely going through those growing pains of constantly running out of different products and just going, oh, crap, we're out of this now. So, yeah, labels and packaging are just a constant boom. I look forward to one day where we have a dedicated team to doing this and I can focus on the higher level things. But in the meantime, it's the challenge of scale. You know, if you don't have the large team or the large pocketbook to solve all these problems, you just got to be scrappy. But I also think this is what people want to see. They want to see you be scrappy. They want to see what happens when you get kicked in the gut. You stay down or you figure out a problem, you know, how you solution your problem. You know, nowadays I don't stress out too much about it. I just realize, okay, get on the phone, start making things happen. And, you know, maybe I've yelled at a few of my vendors a little louder than I should have, and I apologize. I'm just trying to make my orders. Bear with me, and I ask for forgiveness if I, you know, you're listening. But, yeah, you know, I always sometimes forget that my vendors are like my own partners, too, and we got to rely on them. It's important to have that relationship and trust. But stuff happens. If you've built that trust and relationship, then hopefully they're there to help solve any issues that arise up. But beyond that, you know, just a lot going on. And then I'm looking at going to Houston for the next 3 weeks. So I've got a lot of on-the-road time coming up again, getting out there, you know, doing demo. Like I said, fourth quarter is coming around that corner. So now we're just kind of doing some early marketing, starting to build that name. One of our stores, or one of our customers, is opening another store. I swear, I love this company. They're one of the fastest growing retailers in the country. And I swear, in Texas, since we've been with them about a year and a half, they have doubled the number of stores. For us, it's scary, it's cool, but it's also another store that now we have to support, figure out how we're going to get out there and squeeze all my time on weekends into even another store. We'll solve it. If anything, the pain is going to start getting so great that we're going to actually have to do what I need to do, which is start to hire a street marketing team, somebody that can kind of be a regional rep and go out there and do the tastings and demos, and maybe a little merchandising, and maybe open up some new accounts. That would be kind of nice. What else is going on? I think on the finance side, you know, we're still continuing to work on the pitch deck, making some progress. You know, this week definitely not as much as I wanted to, because we've just been busy trying to get these orders out. We'll see how progress is going on that. Not really exciting what's going on. It's just busy, busy, busy. Having fun. Had our first formal meeting. She ran it. She had an agenda. I had to take notes. I sent out notes to everybody. So it was like, hey, this is a structured company meeting. It was kind of great. There's, you know, it was five or six of us at this meeting. Kind of, I love seeing her run the meetings a lot better than I do. She stays on point and structured and, you know, everything that I'm not, right? She balances me. Well, that's about it for the Madge's moment for this week. Stay tuned next week as we have the episode 2 of James Cantor. I'm going to tease you. It is so worth it, so please tune back in. Again, if you felt that you got a lot of value out of this, please share. Go to iTunes, Google, Spotify, Anchor, any of your podcasts. Subscribe. Go back. Listen to some early episodes. We've got some great guests. And we got some more coming down the pipeline. I'm looking forward here soon. We've got some guests coming out of Austin that I've been building relationships over the last several months. It's been a busy week for them because it's East Expo East back in Baltimore. So a lot of them are back there. So anyway, one of these days we'll be there ourselves. But in the meantime, so yeah, tune back in next week to see episode 2. We thank you so much for listening to My Fermented Life. I'm your host, Mike Miller. And I'm going to go finish the cigar. Otherwise, you two, enjoy.